Welcome to Cleveland Clinic Health Talk Podcasts, featuring presentations by leading Cleveland Clinic physicians and medical experts. Today's speaker, Jillian Culbertson, presents Eating to Protect Your Bones.
All right, so my part of this, switching gears a little bit and talking a little bit more about protecting the bones and eating healthy to protect the bones. Let's see how this works here. Okay. So the objectives, understand a little bit about what a healthy bone is. I'm not going to spend too much time on this part of it. Discuss some of the issues that we might see with bone loss, and then the most important part, gain knowledge, some nutrition strategies to help you with bone health. So just, you know, to get started here, why do we have bones? I think the obvious that we think of for structure and support and protection. I don't think we really think about one of the roles of the skeleton as a reservoir, and it is a very important, has an important role for as a source of calcium and phosphorus, which is needed for a whole bunch of processes in the body. This, when we think of it as a reservoir, it's very sensitive to a lot of different influences. It's a complex regulatory system that works on the bones, intestines, and the kidney, affecting absorption and resorption and so forth. If your intake is low on a particular nutrient, when we think of the what's needed for the blood, you know, the blood levels need to be maintained pretty closely. If you're not getting certain foods from your diet in order to maintain those blood levels, it's going to take it from the bank, which we can think of the bones or the skeleton in that respect as a bank. The skeleton is not a static system. It's changing all the time. There's always a process of tearing down parts of the bone and rebuilding parts of the bone. It's modeling and remodeling throughout life. The skeleton will actually change over several times during your life, and it's estimated that every 10 years you really end up with a whole new skeleton. Some of the factors that affect bone, genetics, obviously we don't have much influence over that. You know, our skeleton is designed to have certain functions as the species in general, and amongst different changes within ourselves, genetics has a big influence in how we store bones, or how we store our calcium in our minerals, how we lose it, maybe possibly how we build bones in the first place. Diet we'll get to in a minute, I'm not really skipping it, and lifestyle factors that we'll talk about. Stress and mechanical forces. Exercise is a really important part of bone health, and I will mention that quite a few times. It's one of those use it or lose it approaches, so if you don't stress your bones or really use your bones, they're going to weaken. A really good example is astronauts with space travel. They're very healthy individuals. If they go up in that weightless atmosphere, they quickly lose their bone mass. So you got to put the stress on it. Those impact exercises are really important, walking, so forth. And also the amount and architecture can improve with mechanical loading, which is exercise. So not just building more bone mass, making it better and making it stronger. So bone is a composite material. It's made up of crystals of mineral bound to protein. We already heard about the hydroxyapatite, which is crystals of calcium and phosphorus, and it's bound to protein, and that's what gives it the strength and a little bit of flexibility. So there is some resilience to bone. Without it, it would fracture really easy, so it has to be able to absorb some impact as well. The protein part is collagen. Collagen is actually formed by the bone, and then it's interwoven in different filaments in a way that makes it much stronger. When we look at bone itself, it's hollow, typically, and that's what makes it strong and yet not too heavy. The dense outer shell is the cortical bone, and the inner part is the trabecular bone, and it's a network of connecting plates and rods, and this is really where a lot of the strength comes from, and it actually serves two purposes. One is the strength, and the other part is mineral exchange, because there's a lot of surface area to function in that respect. The trabecular bone is abundant in the, there's a typo there, in the ends of the long bones, and ends of the long bones in the spine, and these are areas that are typically going to have a lot more impact and a lot more movement, so it needs to have more strength and as well as a little more flexibility. Those are a lot of the areas that if one is losing bone mass or losing bone density, those are some of the areas that we're going to see more fractures. Bones change throughout life. Modeling and remodeling is a process by which bones change. Modeling is typically more predominant when bones are growing, like teens and kids and teens. It's where bone is taken from one site and put in the other, which allows for growth. Remodeling becomes a little more important as we get older. It's where it's kind of like repairing the same site. You could think of it that way. So if there are any fractures or little issues within the bone, it repairs that. both processes do occur throughout life, but again, remodeling is a little more predominant later. Its role is to repair damage. It also prevents accumulation of old bone. So if too much old bone accumulates in one spot, it loses the flexibility, becomes very rigid, and is more likely to fail or fracture. It's the remodeling that also has a particular role when we think of that reservoir function. So with the breaking down bone, some of those calcium and phosphorus are released. Some of the issues of bone loss, there's really a number of issues that can happen. It's excessive breakdown of bone, typically from the osteoclasts. Those are when the breakdown bone and the osteoclasts build bone. There's some genetic things that can happen to bone. Hyperparathyroidism can cause excessive breakdown of bone, Paget's disease, fibrous dysplasia. You can have vitamin D deficiencies for osteomalacia. I'm not going to go into too much detail with those. There can also be localized loss from inflammatory responses. So if you think of arthritis, you have a rheumatoid arthritis, I should say, you have a lot of inflammation in one area, and there actually can be bone loss just locally related to those inflammatory responses. The most common, and probably it's not the most important, but the most common issues of bone loss is the osteopenia and the osteoporosis, and I think we're going to talk about that more than anything, because that's a common issue and something we really need to address. So it is an issue of low bone mineral density and compromised strength. It is very common. It's estimated, and there are different estimates of how common it is, but one in three women over the age of 50 will have an issue with osteoporosis. Men do get it as well, typically a little bit later in life, about 10 years later or so, and it's estimated that one in five men over the age of 50 will have issues with osteoporosis. So why are we going to worry about it? It is very devastating, causes a lot of pain, a lot of disability. It is a silent disease, which means it progresses without any symptoms. You don't know you're having a problem until something arises, which usually the first sign of osteoporosis is going to be a fracture. Other common signs might be loss of height. So if someone loses a couple inches of height in a short period of time, you might suspect osteoporosis. The bending over, the hump in the back, the Dowager's hump is an issue that we might see. Postmenopausal women have the greatest risk of osteoporosis, and this is really due to the decreased estrogen levels. 50% of patients with a hip fracture will not walk independently again, and they may end up requiring long-term care facility, and then for some people, it starts a downward spiral, which can lead to mortality within the next year. So postmenopause women, again, increased bone mass. The bone loss occurs rapidly, 2 to 6 times faster rate than bone is built. It will eventually slow down. After about 10 years or so, it'll slow down to about a 1% loss annually. So some of the common fracture sites that we might see: hip, and that of course is the most serious, has the most serious consequences like we talked about. We may see fractures of the spine, and that can be very painful. Forearm and wrist, and fractures of the humerus. So those are some of the more common areas. And again, fracture might be the first sign. Those who are at increased risk for bone loss are those with, of course, advancing age, definitely a risk factor there. Family history, there is definitely a genetic component to that. Ethnicity, all races will get osteoporosis, but those who are white, Asian, or Latino tend to be a little bit of greater risk. And those with a sedentary lifestyle, so that's a very easily modifiable factor there, get out and get moving. Smoking and alcohol use will tend to cause more issues or have greater risk for osteoporosis. A slim body type, so if you weigh less, there's less stress or less work on the skeleton. And certain medications, steroids, corticosteroids, they can cause some bone loss and some diseases as well. So what is a healthy bone? This just is a nice little picture of a healthy bone, and you can see those nice uniform small little circles of the nice network there, versus the bone with osteoporosis. There's open spots. The network itself has open gaps and is inconsistent. This is another example, and this was a study done of postmenopausal women. It's got the baseline bone on the left side, and then after 1 year without treatment, you can see the loss of bone tissue there, the bone mass. There are a lot of medications. So when we talk about the untreated bone here, there's a lot of medications that could be helpful for preserving bone mass. I'm not going to go into that. So when we talk about bone health, there's really two main strategies. The first would be obtaining peak bone mass in teens and in kids. So we want to make sure kids are getting adequate calcium to build the bank in the first place. So the better the bank is, by the time you reach your adult bone mass, the better it can withstand the withdrawals later in life. Genes and hereditary, we can't control those factors. And again, the external factors, diet and physical activity, you have to do the mechanical loading. Nutrition, bones require the same nutrition elements as really the rest of the body, plus a couple other things to consider, which is higher amounts of calcium and phosphorus, which we're going to talk about. And those are the modifiable risk factors there. So healthy bones require, there's a whole list here. Regular exercise we talked about, I'll talk about it again, sorry you'll hear it a lot. Adequate calcium, adequate vitamin D, those are probably the two most common. Adequate protein, we don't really think about protein as a necessity for bone health, but we'll look at that. Sodium controlled diet, a high sodium diet can increase bone loss. Of course, we don't want to smoke, no excessive alcohol. You want to make sure you have good B12, the omega-3 fatty acids, which we talked about a little bit already, and I'll talk about those. Magnesium, potassium, vitamin K, and trying to get the antioxidants and those anti-inflammatory foods in there. Some of those we're going to look at a little bit later on when we talk about a vegetarian diet, so we'll get to that in a little bit. So calcium is the most well-known of requirements for healthy bone. It is the most abundant mineral in the body. 99% of calcium is in the skeleton, which is the stores. There is a little bit in the cells and soft tissue, and there's a little bit in the bloodstream and the extracellular fluid. It works in it's necessary in different areas, cardiovascular health, nervous and muscular system requires calcium. So those blood levels need to be maintained, and if you're not getting it from your diet, again, it's going to take it from the bones. Teens have the highest calcium requirement. There's an RDA, either next slide or a couple slides down, and it shows the different requirements for the different ages. The higher calcium is required for the rapidly growing skeleton. Around 20 or early 20s, you achieve your peak bone mass, peak adult bone mass, and that's where the turnover stabilizes a little bit. So the stronger your bones you have at that time, the better it is later on. And then, of course, we have issues with the menopause, which is characterized by more rapid bone loss and increased resorption of the bone. So benefits to getting more calcium in your diet. Unfortunately, there's been some conflicting information in different news reports or research coming out recently regarding calcium. And when you think of nutrition as a science, it is fairly young, and we're learning much more about the body processes and how things work, so things change. And unfortunately, sometimes we say, well, we used to tell you this, but now we're telling you this. Studies do show that calcium is beneficial for bone health. So this study showed that there was reduced hip fractures in older women who were compliant taking calcium and vitamin D. It's possible that some of these conflicting reports are related to the fact that you're better off getting it from dairy sources. There might be some neutral benefits to taking calcium supplements, so it is better from the diet, probably because it does contain vitamin D, protein, magnesium, and potassium, which all work together for bone health. Calcium intake tends to decline with advancing age, and I think there's a couple reasons for this. I think in general our tastes change. I know as people get older, they tend to take less dairy. Women especially are always concerned about weight control, and unfortunately dairy is a common area for that to go. We may end up seeing more lactose intolerance as people get older. We do know that 50% of girls over the age of 15 have inadequate calcium intake. And when you get to be 35, 75% of people have inadequate calcium intake. So it is an issue. In general, men get more calcium than women do. As you get older, intestinal absorption of calcium decreases. And of course, the estrogen deficiency results in increase in urinary calcium excretion. So those are some of the issues when it comes to calcium. And we already talked about some of these increased risks for inadequate calcium intake, those who are older, lactose intolerant. Vegetarian diets we're going to talk about a little bit differently because we can look at some of those other factors for a healthy diet. Those with poor eating habits, obviously if you don't eat a healthy diet, you're not going to getting your calcium in or any of the fruits and vegetables in those healthy foods either. Dietary sources of calcium, dairy is the biggest one. High elemental calcium, high absorption rate, and low cost. So it is likely better to get it from your diet. Other sources are going to be leafy greens, nuts, and beans. If you can't get it from your diet at this point anyway, supplements are still recommended to determine how much you need. You can kind of figure out what you're getting from your diet and then do the difference. The rest can come from supplements. If you do take supplements, you can't absorb more than about 500, 600, or 600 milligrams at one time, so it would need to be taken in separate doses. And there's some guidelines. The calcium carbonate better absorbed with food tends to be less expensive. Calcium citrate is well absorbed with or without food. So here's the RDA. It'll show, you can see where the teens have the highest calcium requirement, and then it goes down a little bit up to over 50. It goes up to the 1,200 milligrams for women. There are different recommendations for calcium. I threw this one in here because you're going to see different recommendations. So especially for those who are at risk, women over 30, 1,200 milligrams per day in divided doses is a recommendation. Postmenopausal women, there's a recommendation for 1,500 milligrams a day, and that again would have to be in divided doses. At 1,500, I would say three doses would be better absorbed than trying to get it in two. Calcium intake up to 1,500 milligrams, especially from dairy sources, does not increase kidney stones. That's a concern some people have about increasing their calcium. And dairy calcium is probably a little bit protective when it comes to the kidney stones. There isn't much benefit seen taking over 1,500 milligrams, and the tolerable upper limit is estimated about 2,500 milligrams of calcium. When you're looking at a food label for calcium, what you're going to do is, first of all, always pay attention to the serving size. See what the serving size is, the food. When you go down and see the calcium, it's listed in a percent. So this is 30% of 1,000. So what you would do, or I'm sorry, what would you do is take this number and add a zero, and basically it would give you your milligrams of calcium. So in this example, if it's a cup of milk, you get 30% of your calcium needs. So it's 300 milligrams of calcium. So that's how you could figure it out on a label. Those who are lactose intolerant, there are plenty of options to get calcium from your dairy sources. You can always try the lactose-free milk, Lactaid. There's the calcium-fortified soy products. There's almond milk. There's rice milk. There's hemp milk. A lot of different products out there. You can always do the Lactaid tablets with your dairy products. Certain people who have more of a mild lactose intolerance might not be able to drink milk, but they can certainly do yogurt or Greek yogurt because it has less lactose in it. And cheese is often tolerated if it's not a really severe lactose intolerance. You might try cottage cheese, the low lactose cheeses, lactose-free yogurt if you still have trouble. There are non-dairy foods that are good sources of calcium, the broccoli, beans, the dark greens and leafy vegetables, sardines with the bones, of course. Calcium-rich juices, there's a lot of calcium-fortified foods out there, blackstrap, molasses, roasted almonds, tofu processed with calcium is a good source as well. So I have a couple slides that just shows the calcium content in different foods. So if you're aiming for 400 milligrams of calcium, yogurt's a good source. Half a cup of evaporated skim milk, I don't think we use that typically in our diet every day, but that's a good source. Half a cup of dry milk powder is a great way of increasing calcium and protein in your diet. For 300 milligrams, milk, fruit and yogurt, calcium-fortified juices are made to be equivalent to milk. Parmesan cheese, ricotta cheese, Swiss. Again, the calcium-treated tofu is mentioned again. Cereal bars, there's a lot of calcium-fortified products out there, and the sardines. If you're aiming for 200 milligrams, natural cheese, calcium-fortified cereals, 150 milligrams, instant oatmeal calcium-fortified, pudding, custards, that sounds like a good way to get calcium. Collard greens, salmon with the bones, calcium-fortified graham crackers, I admit I haven't seen those, but apparently they exist, and calcium-fortified bread. And then it goes down to 150. So non-fat cream cheese, turnip greens, almonds, ice cream, another good way to get your calcium in, white beans, broccoli, again, some of your greens, kale, mustard greens, cottage cheese, a corn tortilla, a medium orange has calcium in it, and a tablespoon of the dry milk powder. So we saw where you did a half a cup earlier. If you just threw a tablespoon in something to get a little more calcium, that works well too. Dry milk powder is a great way to increase some nutrition in your diet. It goes to anything that has like a water content, so it mixes in very well. Moving on to vitamin D, also a well-known component for bone health. Intake is typically inadequate. There's very few natural food sources that are rich in vitamin D. Most of it is coming from fortified dairy products. It is in some of the fattier fish, salmon, tuna, mackerel, herring. Smaller amounts in beef liver, cheese, egg yolk, some fortified juices and cereals, and some soy beverages. Also ultraviolet light treated mushrooms, we'll see that in a little bit. It is synthesized in the skin, requires 10 minutes of sun exposure, and of course there's issues because here in Ohio we don't see much sun for 6 months of the year. We're using sunscreen more, so we're not going to get as much vitamin D that way. And those with darker skin tones tend to not make as much vitamin D. Those at risk of deficiency are those who are older age, frail, chronically ill, housebound in northern latitudes. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. It's essential for regulation and absorption of calcium, so we need to have it, and a variety of other functions. Maintains normal serum calcium and phosphorus levels for the mineralization of bone, needed for bone growth and remodeling, and lots of other roles, modulation of cell growth, neuromuscular and immune functions, functions in reducing inflammation, and more. So some vitamin D fortified foods, milk, you can see the levels that are listed here. Some juices, the level does vary. Some margarines, soy milk, again, levels vary, and yogurts. Foods naturally rich in vitamin D foods, there's not a whole heck of a lot. Cod liver oil, again, I don't know how many people take that. Egg yolk, fattier fish, the mushrooms treated with the light. So what you can do this even on your own. If you take mushrooms and stick it in the sunlight for an hour, you'll get about 10 micrograms or the 400 IU of vitamin D. So the sunlight stimulates the vitamin D in the mushrooms. There are some suppliers or growers that will treat the mushrooms to a little bit of sunlight, but it actually says it on the label. The RDA for vitamin D is listed here. Upper limit, about 50 micrograms or 2,000 IU per day. We don't usually think about protein as important for bone health, but it is. It was at one time thought that protein was detrimental to bone health, but now we know that it is important. It is a major component of bone, and it is estimated the RDA might be too low for bone health, especially in the elderly. It does enhance muscle retention, which can indirectly help bones. The more muscle you have, the more, in general, better bone status, strength, flexibility, stamina, etc. The increase of calcium in the urine that we see with high protein diet is not associated with decrease in bone. So that's why at one point it was thought that it was negative. High protein diet, it's a little bit, there's a lot of different information when we talk about the acid load of a diet. But some of the higher protein foods have a higher potential renal acid load. And this might increase calcium absorption in markers of bone health. So definite benefit to high protein diets. We don't usually think of that. It used to be thought that obesity was a little bit protective of bone health, but it turns out it's probably more related to the increased muscle mass as opposed to the fat mass. There's a definite association between visceral fat and bone marrow adipose tissue, so it seems that some of the substrate that might go towards bone building instead is going to the fat in the bones rather than to the good part of the bone that we want it to. It seems like the subcutaneous fat is neutral and maybe beneficial, but it's the visceral fat, the stuff that's inside and around the organs, that's negative. Might be related to hormones, inflammation, oxidative stress, etc. Fractures, for those who are obese, are more likely to be in the ankle and the upper leg and not necessarily hip. Maybe there's more padding there. And diabetes, we definitely see bone strength that's lower despite, in some cases, greater density. The quality of the bone might be compromised. Those who have diabetes might be more prone to falls. There's maybe issues with hypoglycemia, neuropathy, retinopathy. So if you have diabetes, I think it's definitely important to be evaluated for issues of bone loss. Phosphorus, it's actually, we need phosphorus in the diet. As far as, we need phosphorus for bone health, but the levels that we're getting is really difficult to assess. It could be that when we talk about phosphorus, some of it's detrimental, some of it's positive. There's inorganic versus organic phosphorus. The inorganic phosphorus are usually the things that are added to foods, and that's a level that's really hard to determine what we're getting. There's some phosphorus that added to meats in order to make a better texture and retain moisture content, and those levels have not been reported. So how much we're actually getting is really unclear. Other areas, the convenience foods that we tend to use, maybe more of those inorganic phosphates, and those found in cola. So we know it's an issue when you have a lower calcium to phosphorus ratio, probably related to those inorganic phosphates more than anything. Those with the lower calcium phosphorus ratio, it leads to more bone resorption or bone loss, a low peak bone mass in, you know, when kids are younger or younger adults, and more bone fragility. And talking about that acid-base issue right there, so high phosphorus diet might cause more of an acid diet as opposed to an alkaline diet. There are people who are trying to follow more of a basic diet or more alkaline diet. When it comes to bone health, there's no evidence to support a benefit to that. But there might be some indirect benefits. If you're following an alkaline diet, so to speak, there's going to be more fruits and vegetables. This can improve your sodium-potassium ratios, which may benefit bone health. Helps to reduce muscle wasting. It may help with other diseases because it is a healthy diet. May help with, you know, blood pressure, heart disease. These diets tend to have more magnesium, which is needed to activate vitamin D, may increase growth hormone to improve cardiovascular health, memory, and cognition. So there might be benefits to it that's not really related to bone status. So we're going to talk about the vegetarian and vegan diet because there was a couple things listed on the slide previous back necessary for bone health that we haven't talked about yet. I'm going to talk about this because a lot of people are moving towards a vegan diet and there can be some dietary concerns. As people get older, they tend to eat less dairy products, less meat products, and leaning more towards a vegetarian diet for health. Kids these days, or teenagers, I should say, are going, and young adults are going more towards a vegan diet for ethical reasons, so I think it's important to talk about it. The vegan diet will contain more beneficial nutrients, magnesium, potassium, vitamin K, those antioxidants, vitamin C and E and carotenoids, and a lot of those anti-inflammatories that are going to be from fruits, vegetables, nuts, beans, tea, and herbs. Tends to be more alkaline protein sources. Greater risk for some deficiencies. We see lower bone mineral density and greater fracture risk in those who follow a vegan diet. So there are issues. Looking at calcium, we know the benefit of calcium in the diet. Supplements might show limited benefits, so therefore it's better to get it from diet sources, and the biggest source is going to be from the dairy products, which of course if you're vegan you're not having. Plant sources are not going to be as bioavailable, so it is important to make sure you're getting adequate calcium in the diet. Vitamin D, we saw the benefits to a vitamin D in the diet. The main food sources, dairy, egg yolks, and fatty fish. Again, vegans are not having these. So most vegetarians have a low vitamin D intake. Again, the vitamin C exposure or the sun exposure can help. And supplements. I think supplements are definitely indicated there. B12, so that was on that slide, is important for protecting bones. This is, we get it almost exclusively from animal products. Low B12 will cause increased bone remodeling and bone loss and elevated homocysteine level, which can has been associated with increased fracture risk, probably related to decreased linking of those collagen, the proteins in bone. A low B12 has been found in 11% of omnivores, so people who eat everything, 11% people have a low B12, versus 92% of the vegans. Sources for a vegan is going to be the fortified food, soy, nutritional yeast, and supplements. Zinc, lower zinc associated with osteoporosis. These sources are high in meat, also in nuts, beans, and whole grains. There's phytates in these that might limit the bioavailability. So if it's a vegetarian, you're getting more sources from the plants, you need to aim for about 50% more. Processes like soaking, heating them, sprouting, fermenting, and leavening may assist in getting that zinc out of the foods. Protein, again, we talked about. Higher protein diets lead to greater bone mineral density and lower fracture risk. It's questionable whether animal protein versus plant protein has much of an effect. Vegetarians in general have a lower protein intake, but it might be that because the proteins are more alkaline, it might kind of negate that difference a little bit. Fatty acids, when we think about those omega-3s, it's very complex. It might affect the inflammatory processes. It may help with calcium transport, may help protect the bone. Typically, the most active source is going to be the EPA and DHA, and this is typically from fish. The animal sources are the fish and the marine sources. Vegetarians tend to get more omega-6s as opposed to omega-3s. Some omega-3s can come from the plant sources, which is the ALA, alpha, linoleic acid, which can turn into the DHA and the EPA, but is inefficient. And supplements for omega-3s for vegetarians can be the algae supplements. Also chia seeds, flax seeds, walnuts, those are also good sources. So coming to the end of this, just to recap a little bit, the healthy diet for bones should include, we know this, adequate calcium. It's definitely important to get adequate calcium in your diet, probably more from diet as opposed to supplements. Adequate vitamin D, adequate protein, it does help with help give you higher bone mineral density, should include magnesium, potassium, vitamin K, and good omega-3s, which we saw. It would be a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables because it's going to help provide all of those. A healthy diet is kind of lifestyle, but should include regular exercise. Very important to work the bones to help build that bone mass. You shouldn't smoke. You should limit alcohol and limit sodium. Sodium is kind of interesting. I didn't mention that, I guess. But if you have a high sodium diet without adequate calcium, it can lead to more bone loss. So that's just an overview of what the healthy diet for a diet for healthy bones would be.
Thank you for listening to Cleveland Clinic Health Talk Podcasts. For more information, please visit our website at clevelandclinic.org/health.